speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy.
May the turbulence of our age yield to the true time of peace, when men and nations shall share a life that honors the dignity of each, the brotherhood of all.
I see a world of open borders, open trade, and most importantly, open mind.
Hello and welcome to the Republic, a show dedicated to history and U.S. institutions. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
And Jeff is back.
And I'm here. I'm doing it. Okay, I'm only here, one, because I want to be, and two, because of the topic.
Yeah.
You suggested the topic this week and or this month or whatever. How often are you doing these?
Once per month.
Okay, this month. And I was like, I'm on board. I love this. I want
to
do it.
Yeah. So just to kind of, I guess, preface the topic, if you've been listening to us every month, you've noticed like since Matt has kind of filled your chair a little bit while you've taken a step back, we've mostly focused on international issues. But with everything going on domestically, I think we would be doing a huge disservice in a multitude of ways if we didn't come back refocused on where the show originally started, which is focusing on U.S. institutions and U.S. history and the stuff that is relevant today. Because
civics.
I forgot that in our intro. anyway, the So I thought that what better time to talk about the issue of voting rights and voter suppression in this country and the long history that it's had, because one, we have a very important election coming up, and two, this country seems to be kind of having a great cultural awakening at the moment. At least it appears to be that way. We hope the momentum sticks around, so you know some real fundamental change can occur, because there's a real problem out there that we're trying to rectify.
I think this will be a good balance episode to counter another episode that you and I did was voting. So just trying to inform as much as we can, but when it comes to voting, have different angles that we're approaching the subject on.
Oh, definitely. And voting, I think, is something we've talked about a lot. Well, both we've done an entire episode on voting before, but we talk about it a lot on our podcast, Say What You Mean. And you know, without voting, our democracy ceases to exist. And this is the biggest, most fundamental right that all of us do as Americans. And when voices are being silenced, We're not truly living up to our constitutional promises, and we're not preserving our democracy. So I think by shedding a light on some of these practices, both historically and modern, we can hopefully do our part to affect the change that has needed to happen for a long time. So I thought we would just kind of get rolling into it. But before we do that, I need to just talk about some of the stuff going on with the radio station, KXRW. There's a lot of good programs to listen to. John Oberg's Filibusters or Joe Clemens's The Common Good. Both do a great job talking about local topics, getting especially Filibusters gets a lot of local people on. They had Governor Jay Inslee on just to talk about local politics, stuff that's going on in our local community. So very relevant stuff. Also, listenership and donations keep us on the air. And if you like what KXRW is doing, please go to KXRW's website. There's a link that you can follow to and donate there. We really would really, really, really appreciate it. And just wanted to say thank you guys all for listening. And now to this month's episode of To the Republic, which I kind of just titled Voting Rights.
Oh, okay.
So just kind of basic. But okay. I thought we would start with where kind of this started. After the Civil War, the country kind of shifted towards more of a modern era, with the role of the federal government definitely changed a lot after the Civil War. There was one historian that we read in college that talked about how the Civil War almost acted as a second American Revolution, because it so changed the way that the states interacted with the federal government and the role of the federal government and more of the birth of federalism. So with that, the Civil War ended in 1865. So in 1867, the Republican-led Congress, along with President Andrew Johnson, imposed military rule over southern states that rebelled against the U.S. This was to, in a lot of ways, to make sure, one, the South didn't try rebelling again, but two, is to make sure that the newly freed slaves weren't being re-oppressed back into new forms of servitude. Southern states, in order to be readmitted into the Union, had to ratify new constitutions that removed a lot of the wording about institutions of slavery and other forms of suppression and oppression. And then were only in, and then the other stipulation is that they had to ratify the 14th Amendment in order to be readmitted into the Union. In 1870, the U.S. Congress, in a two-thirds majority of the states, passed the 15th Amendment, which stated that the right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous conditions of servitude. At that time, more than half a million black men became voters in the 1870s, and of course, you know, women weren't allowed to vote until 1920. So there was still a significant part of the population that was still not eligible to vote. But so, as an example, from the time Mississippi was readmitted in 1870 until Reconstruction ended in 1877, the state elected two black senators to the federal government and numerous state and House representatives. However, when Black Reconstruction ended, Black voter participation dropped significantly because of threats by white employers or violence from the Ku Klux Klan.
And those are two forms of suppression.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I was thinking about and I'll let you continue, but one thing I was thinking about when approaching this is institutional forms of suppression, mm-hmm. but also social forms of suppression.
Yeah,
and as you just mentioned, the work being, you know, workplaces and finding different ways to manipulate your work, or your employer finding a way to manipulate the job mm-hmm. to prevent you from voting is something that is seen, I think, sometimes even today.
Yeah.
But sorry, continue.
No, you're good. I just, military rule obviously protected polling places, and when African Americans began voting and voting in people who had their interests at heart. Obviously, there are a lot of other social reforms happened in terms of just basically allowed people that were secondary to this issue of voting, but ultimately created this space that allowed African Americans after slavery ended to feel comfortable voting and being allowed to even get to polling places, because as we'll see under Reconstruction, there was you're talking about social barriers to overcome, is that there were basically mobs at some polling places that wouldn't even allow certain people to get to the polls for fears of lynching or other threats of violence.
Right.
When Reconstruction ended after the election of Rutherford B. Hayes, and the Republican Party at the federal level had been dealing with a lot of corruption, and there was some backroom dealings, but it was a very, very close election, and Hayes, being the Republican, made a deal with some of the southern states that if he ended Reconstruction, that the way the delegates worked out, that he would win re-election. So we don't have to get into that convoluted history, but because of that Reconstruction and other things, Reconstruction ended in 1877, and almost instantaneously, southern states started reenacting new forms of voter suppression, knowing that because of the passage of the 15th Amendment, they couldn't outwardly just stop African American men from voting, but they had to, they came up with some other very effective ways. So Republicans in the South that were elected during Reconstruction were quickly replaced by segregationist Democrats, which enacted laws banning interracial marriages, racially segregated railway cars, and public schools. Laws and practices were adopted to make sure blacks would never be able to vote freely again. Mississippi, for example, rewrote their state constitution in 1890. Its new constitution included an annual poll tax, which voters had to pay 2 years before an election. Since black Mississippians made up the poorest part of the state's population, many couldn't afford to pay it. Even worse, Mississippi instituted a literacy test. It required a person seeking to register to vote to read a section of the state constitution and explain it to the county clerk who processed voter registration. This clerk was always white and decided whether a citizen was literate or not.
Wow. I think I've read about that before.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, like there, the system, when we talk about the term, the systemic racism,
right,
or a systemic, you know, systemic segregation, when public schools are being segregated and then funding is only being channeled to white schools, right, black schools being underfunded, which means that the quality of education is going to be lower. But in order to vote, they have to pass a literacy test. But the literacy rates are going to be very, very, very low. And then even if they could afford to pay, because schools are segregated, they're not getting the quality of education, which just, I mean, all these things just keep stacking on top of each other. Mississippi also enacted a grandfather clause that permitted registering for anyone whose grandfather was qualified to vote before the Civil War. Obviously, this benefited only white citizens, because obviously before the Civil War, only whites could vote because blacks were enslaved.
Right.
The grandfather clause, as well as the other legal barriers to black voting registration, worked. Mississippi cut the percentage of black voting age men registered to vote from more than 90% during Reconstruction to less than 6% in 1892. Wow. So in less than 20 years, you had an 84% drop in voter registration amongst African Americans in Mississippi.
Through these institutional barriers. Yeah.
These measures were also copied by most of the states in the South. As a result of intimidation, violence, and racial discrimination in state voting laws, a mere 3% of voting age black men and women in the South were registered to vote in 1940. In Mississippi, less than 1% were registered. Most blacks who did vote were in larger cities in the South. Wow. In Louisiana, more than 130,000 black voters had registered to vote. In 1896, the number had plummeted to just 1,342 in 1904. Mm-hmm. In 8 years, it dropped by 128,000 people.
Wow.
By not having the power of the ballot, African Americans in the South had little influence in their communities. They did not hold elected offices. They had no say in how much their taxes would be or what laws would be passed. Mm-hmm. They had little, if any, control over local police, courts, or public schools.
Right.
They, in effect, were denied the very rights of being U.S. citizens.
Right.
So you can see how the blocking of voting leads to so many other social issues, right, that we're still dealing with today.
Well, even the path of like combating the voter suppression simply starts with the ability to vote. So you vote for where the school funding goes, like you said earlier in your example. Well, you want more funding to go to because schools are segregated. You want more funding to go to black schools. Well, because of voter suppression, now you can't vote for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it leads to that, you know, illiteracy. And it's just, you can just see how everything is just stacking or just puzzle piece together to make sure that anything that you might want to vote for is just impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Yeah, it truly is that. And then you see quickly that how, even though the Constitution says one thing, there's so many ways in which that can be manipulated or just honestly just kind of ignored.
Right.
Because obviously the original intent of the 14th and 15th Amendment weren't to allow these things to happen, but yet they did for almost basically a century,
right,
before the Voting Rights Act, and we're still trying, even today, we're still trying to make sure that the Voting Rights Act's promises are being fulfilled across the board and equally. And as we'll talk about with the Voting Rights Act, I mean, there was a repeal of part of it in 2013 by the Supreme Court, which has allowed a lot of the modern issues to crop up.
One thing I was going to say about just looking at the history of all of this is how significant voting is,
mm-hmm,
how important it is, what it does, what it means. And when you take that away and you don't have representation, you don't have a voice in your country, just look at the importance and significance of allowing people to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So people all the time, I think you have disgruntled voters even today, especially today. But you look at the history and how important it was and why people fought for it, because it does matter.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see through the intentional suppression.
Yeah.
There's obviously a reason people wanted to suppress votes,
mm-hmm,
and to keep a status quo,
yeah,
or prevent change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it gets into the term that's often used is disenfranchisement, and I think that's such a perfect term to encapsulate everything that's going on, because I think when you're not voting, you don't feel a part of the society around you. You feel I don't know. Thankfully, I've never had my voting rights limited in any way, shape, or form. So right. I don't know what it's like. But I can imagine, like, imagine what it would be like to, in general, that my vote, because of the way the Electoral College and all that stuff works, just thinking that my vote didn't count. Mm-hmm. But actually having institutional barriers and social pressure telling me that my vote doesn't matter and shouldn't matter, and I can't even cast it even if I wanted to, how much that would detach me from society, mm-hmm. and feel like I'm alienated from society. Right. And that's going to cause a whole lot. And then you have that over generations, that feeling, that is going to drive all sorts of
resentment
in the stuff that we're seeing today, when mm-hmm. people are literally, they're screaming in the streets, protesting these very issues that have long historical roots in our country. Mm-hmm. So with that, I think we'll take a break and hear from our sponsors. When we get back, we'll talk about the Voting Rights Act a bit, and then we'll get into some modern types of voter suppression that we're experiencing today, because it's not as today's modern voter suppression isn't as outward and as just in your face as it was during the Reconstruction era through the Civil Rights movement, but it's still an effective tool for those who wish to wield it to suppress the votes of minorities. So when we get back, we'll talk about that. I am your host, Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
We'll be right back.
The COVID crisis has created a critical shortage of personal protection masks. Now that the Center for Disease Control has recommended that everyone should wear masks, the need is even more urgent. The Columbia Springs Repair Clark County program has instructions on how to sew and where to share personal protection masks. You can find Repair Clark County on Facebook or go to columbiasprings.org/repair. That's columbiasprings.org/repair.
KXRW would like to thank our friends at NuVamsterdam for supporting our programming. NuVamsterdam is the premier cannabis market in the Vancouver area. They carry a variety of cannabis products ranging from pre-rolls, vape cartridges, and edibles to CBD topicals, oils, and tinctures. NuVamsterdam is located in the Heights Shopping Center on the corner of Mill Plain and Andreessen Road. Open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. 365 days a year. More information available at NuVamsterdam.com. That's NuVamsterdam.com.
KXRW Radio would like to help spread the word about food availability in Clark County for people in need in this extraordinary time. If you need food, Clark County Food Bank's partners are located in 21 sites throughout Clark County. The complete list is updated daily. You can find it at clarkcountyfoodbank.org. Once you're there, click on the button that says Get Food During COVID-19. If you can't visit a distribution site, ask a friend or neighbor to go in your place. They'll be able to pick up a food box for you. If you or a friend can't make it, email info@clarkcountyfoodbank.org. They may be able to deliver food to your door in some situations. And finally, if you would like to help, go to clarkcountyfoodbank.org and click on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. Every dollar donated will help meet the food needs of our most vulnerable population. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
And on our last segment, we were talking about the history of voter suppression, institutional voting barriers, like poll taxes, literacy tests that were enacted in the South after Reconstruction ended in 1877, and how those carried through to the Civil Rights Movement in the late 1950s through 1960s, and so now we're going to talk about how those institutional barriers were undercut in 1965 by the Voting Rights Act. Now, you've done some reading on the Voting Rights Act. Did you want to talk about it?
Yeah, just so, I mean, obviously context, you have the civil rights movements in the mm-hmm. 1960s. And what I thought was interesting, so in 1964, the 24th Amendment made poll taxes illegal in federal elections.
Okay.
So that's prior to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So you can see at the federal level, there's kind of a recognition of how that might inhibit mm-hmm. voting, right?
Definitely.
So on August 6, 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signed into law the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The ban act, the use of literacy tests, it provided federal oversight for voter registration in areas where less than 50% of the non-white population had not registered to vote, and authorized the U.S. Attorney General to investigate the use of poll taxes in those state and local elections. Mm-hmm. How? I'm just stunned by that federal integration or federal intervention, mm-hmm. of them like overseeing the registration.
Yeah.
Where the areas were less than 50% mm-hmm. of the non-white population registered.
Yeah.
That, to me, that's just, I just think that's so interesting.
Yeah. And that would, it's what's interesting about that is that that was actually challenged. The Voting Rights Act has been challenged a lot by states, mm-hmm. saying that this targeted, I guess, inspection of areas of the country where certain demographic percentages are met is unconstitutional, because what the federal government is supposed to do, according to interpretation of original intent, is to pass something and have it broadly dispersed, mm-hmm. or broadly enforced,
right.
But this specific targeting was argued that is an overreach of the federal government, right, because they're not supposed to be punishing certain areas. Mm-hmm. But so then when that challenge made it to the Supreme Court in South Carolina v. Katzenbaugh, mm-hmm. In 1966, they upheld the Voting Rights Act. The Supreme Court wrote, Congress had found that case-by-case litigation was inadequate to combat widespread and persistent discrimination in voting because of the inordinate amount of time and energy required to overcome the obstructionist tactics invariably encountered in these lawsuits. After enduring nearly a century of systematic resistance to the 15th Amendment, Congress might well decide to shift the advantage of time and inertia from the perpetrators of evil to its victims. Like, that is really, really pointed language, mm-hmm. coming out of the Supreme Court,
right.
saying that these lawsuits are nothing more than basically resistance tactics to stall the Voting Rights Act.
Right.
And that because of that, the Supreme Court is basically saying Congress has they're granting Congress these special powers to go above and beyond to ensure that voting rights are being upheld, mm-hmm. equally across the country. Mm-hmm. I think that's just an amazing moment of time where you have multiple branches of the federal government upholding these ideals.
Well, not only ideals, but the Constitution.
Yeah,
it's
true.
It's the 15th right? Amendment, mm-hmm. right? So that's why the historical it's significant. It matters here. You know, at the state and local level, the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 wasn't really enforced. But mm-hmm. then you had these cases where people would challenge it, and as it gets brought to the Supreme Court is going to rule in favor of reading and interpreting the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think it all comes back to that 15th Amendment.
Yeah.
And and that is the overseeing law of the land, the Constitution. We all stem from that document, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the 15th Amendment is a part of that at this point.
Yeah.
I just think that there's an argument to be made there, obviously, with the Supreme Court making that argument, that regardless of how you feel about overreach of the federal government, you are living in a land that abides by that Constitution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's a really, really good, that's a really good point, Jeff. And I think that it's just amazing to me to look back and see where they're like, you know, they also bring up the time issue, because these mm-hmm. have persisted for decades,
right.
almost a century, that it's basically saying it's okay that the legislative branch is expanding its powers for right. this specific issue to deal with this systemic long-standing problem, right. and because in also due to all the obstruction that the 15th Amendment, which was supposed to have dealt with this issue and hadn't, the court's basically saying it's been more than time that this needed a change, and we're granting almost extra constitutional powers mm-hmm. to right this wrong,
right.
which I think is such a beautiful moment in U.S. Yes. history, where it's like, we understand that there is something that needs to be changed, and we're going to move heaven and hell mm-hmm. to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I found when I was reading and doing research and I came across that, it just really kind of empowered me. Obviously, we still have, that's not the end all be all.
Right.
Civil rights did not end in 1966 with this ruling, but it made me have hope for the future.
Well, and I'm just chomping at the bit right now, and I won't dive into it, but you know how much I love just reading and researching Supreme Court precedent, right? Mm-hmm. And how important that is. And that language, like you're saying, is setting that tone and setting that standard now of how important voting is.
Mm-hmm.
At that level.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, no, it was I think that was something that we all as Americans can just kind of rally mm-hmm. around that moment of solidarity and overcoming our past and looking to a brighter future. So right. Now I think we'll get into probably a topic that's probably a little bit more close to home, but also a little bit more sad, because I think you realize just how far we still have left to go. We need to talk about modern voter suppression
mm-hmm.
Because it's definitely rampant and it's not as open. So you have to dig a little bit more and talk a little bit more in the nuance of these, of how these things work and how they affect voter registration. So I think we'll try to dive into that a little bit. And you had done some research on modern voter suppression.
One thing I want to say before we dive into this is looking at institutional voter suppression in the modern era.
Sure.
In modern times, it seems to be excused by for the prevention of voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to our voting episode, that we did of the show To the Republic, we discuss at length that not only through our own research, but through professional research, there's almost zero evidence of voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important to mention and note here, because as we go through some of these institutional voter suppression methods, you'll see that it could be excused or used to deny or prevent voter fraud. But that's really just not an issue.
Yeah.
And it's something that we see politicians arguing today all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it just doesn't happen. And if it does happen, it's at decimal percentages,
mm-hmm.
like the smallest percentages.
Yeah, just to give our listeners, just to bring back, because I have some of those statistics from that episode.
Oh, perfect.
The Brennan Center for Justice, which is one of the biggest legal think tanks in our country. The Brennan Center reviewed elections that had been studied for voter fraud by government agencies and private firms. So they gathered public, because the federal
Both.
Government, the
federal, federal and private,
the federal government runs these voter fraud checks periodically throughout mm-hmm. our history. And so the Brennan Center reviewed all available data, and they found instances of voter fraud as a percentage of total votes cast was between 0.0025% to 0.0003%.
Yeah.
That is minuscule. That is not affecting voting at the federal level in any significant way.
Right.
Especially when you're talking about the Electoral College, when the popular vote isn't determining elections anyway.
Right.
So
right.
The study included instances of clerical error and bad data matching.
Mm-hmm.
So that those numbers even drop even lower when you're talking about the
those were included in those percentages?
Yes.
Oh my.
Yeah, so when you're talking about actual people pretending to be somebody else and voting,
yes,
is that those numbers drop even more?
Yeah,
so
when you take those things
exactly.
out. Exactly. Wow. Okay, so the first example I have here of modern voter suppression and these tactics, I mean, I'm sure have been used for decades, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the first one I have is voter ID laws.
Okay.
36 states have identification requirements at the polls. So you could see how that right there could be argued mm-hmm. as preventing voter fraud.
Yeah.
That doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But in that research, I found over 21 million U.S. citizens, I want to specify that because that's another argument that is made when mm-hmm. approaching voter fraud. Over 21 million U.S. citizens do not have government-issued photo identification.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are U.S. citizens who don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And if this was a law, if these are laws, and you know, let's just say this was a national law, that's 21 million people who are now not allowed to vote. not that they can't get their IDs, but there are, again, as we've talked about this whole episode, there are institutional barricades and blockings that prevent just the smallest things like this from being possible.
Yeah, especially when you talk about the 2016 election being what the popular vote difference was 3 million people.
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk about 21 million people being disenfranchised only because they don't have a government issued ID. That can sway, that can change elections much more than this issue of impersonation fraud that keeps being perpetuated in the media.
Right, exactly. So just some things that prevent these IDs from being issued that maybe people aren't thinking about. And I think it's important to note these things, whether it's income or the cost of IDs. Even if they are free, applicants must incur other expenses to obtain underlying documents that are needed to get an ID. And this is just a silly example that I have here, but you know, I'm 33 years old. I don't think I, and this is almost a little embarrassing, I don't think I had my birth certificate until I was like 21.
I don't think I, yeah.
Exactly. I'm in the same boat. Like my mom has it or something, right? But say you were adopted, or say whatever the situation may be, or you're a foster child, like whatever the case may be, you don't have those documents. And now you got to pay to go through these processes to get that stuff. And you have to go down to an office and you have to sit there. And who controls the funding of those offices? Voters, right? Yeah. So again, we're just seeing this just waterfall of everything being tied together. So I just think it's important to know that, like, you know, for some people, you may look at IDs like, just get an ID.
Yeah.
But there are some who just have barricades. And for me, it, just a simple hoop I could jump through is like, hey, mom, you have my birth certificate? I still have to call her and ask for it. You know, and at 21, you know, or 18, I was lazy. I'm not going to do that. Yeah, you know what I mean? Exactly. So then if there was a law that required an ID or required, that's another thing I have on here is some places required like a required those proof of citizenships, like a passport or a birth certificate.
Really?
Yeah. So those are documents that, like we just said, we didn't have until we're older. You're saying you might not even have it in your own possession. I couldn't tell you how old I was when I got my Social Security card. Like, these are just things that, like, especially young voters may not just be carrying around with them. And you have socioeconomic situations that might prevent people from being able to afford these things or get to these things.
Yeah.
And those are just more barricades that prevent voting.
Yeah.
And
when you think about, like, if you had to go get a copy of your birth certificate, right? You
right.
To go, and then
oh, what a chore.
Government buildings are only open 9 to 5. And
yes.
Say you're a working mom of 3 single and you can't go and get, you don't have time to take off, you can't afford to take off work to go to that building to get that birth certificate to then be able to then go to the voter registration office to get registered to vote. There's all of these things that just stack up on each other. And it's so much, I just want to reinforce that issue that there are these barriers, both socially and institutionally, that keep reinforcing these issues of voting.
And I think an important point right there is, as easy it is for you as a listener to just get up and go and vote or get up and get an ID, imagine if that wasn't the case and how important that is.
Yeah.
When you're voting, think about that, that there are people who can't just get up and just do as they wish in the way that you seem to be able to. 36 states have identification requirements at the polls, including 7 states with strict photo ID laws.
36?
36.
Wow. That is a lot.
Gross.
That is, yeah. I'm that's a lot more than I thought.
Yeah. So that I mentioned it earlier, but voter registration restrictions. So proof of citizenship to register to vote. That's where you see that. Passport, birth certificate. Let's see. I have a case right here. In 2011, Kansas Secretary of the State Chris Kobach championed a law requiring Kansans. I didn't know that's how you said that. They were Kansans. To show proof of citizenship documents in order to register to vote, citing false claims of non-citizen voting. There it is. The ACLU sued and defeated the law in 2018.
Interesting.
So that's 7 years.
Wow.
Before it was defeated.
Yeah.
But
if you think about how many elections, both state and federal, went by in those 7 years where those people couldn't vote. Okay, so I think we're going to put a pin in it really quick because I think this is a really top important topic, but we do have to take a break and listen to our sponsors. So anyway, when we get back, I think we're just going to continue. We're just going to roll right back into this. So you've been listening to the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
And we'll be right back.
KXRW Radio would like to help spread the word about food availability in Clark County for people in need in this extraordinary time. If you need food, Clark County Food Bank's partners are located in 21 sites throughout Clark County. The complete list is updated daily. You can find it at clarkcountyfoodbank.org. Once you're there, click on the button that says Get Food during COVID-19. If you can't visit a distribution site, ask a friend or neighbor to go in your place. They'll be able to pick up a food box for you. If you or a friend can't make it, email info@clarkcountyfoodbank.org. They may be able to deliver food to your door in some situations. And finally, if you would like to help, go to clarkcountyfoodbank.org and click on the donate button in the upper right-hand corner of the screen. Every dollar donated will help meet the food needs of our most vulnerable population. Thank you. The COVID crisis has created a critical shortage of personal protection masks. Now that the Center for Disease Control has recommended that everyone should wear masks, the need is even more urgent. The Columbia Springs Repair Clark County program has instructions on how to sew and where to share personal protection masks. You can find Repair Clark County on Facebook or go to columbiasprings.org/repair. That's columbiasprings.org/repair.
Community Radio Like This is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at ADCO1.com. That's ADCO1.com.
Welcome back to the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
And in this episode, we're talking about the issue of voting rights and voter suppression. And before the break, we were talking about modern forms of voter suppression that are occurring today and what are the things that are being done to try to combat those. And just we're just trying to shed a light on this very, very important issue, because I think voting is something that you and I uphold as one of the most fundamental rights in one of the most fundamental acts that we all do as Americans, and right. It's the lifeblood of our democracy. So this is an incredibly important episode and topic to us, so let's just roll right back into it.
I want to say real quickly, if you're enjoying this episode and you're enjoying this show, share with your friends, please. You can find our episodes up on KXRW or in our podcast feed, say what you mean. Mm-hmm. But I just want to say, like, we put a lot of work into this, and we do this, and we're passionate about it. Obviously, you can hear it.
Yeah.
So please share with your friends, and if you enjoy it, like, learn, like, keep learning, stay informed. I'm going to continue real quick on voter registration restrictions.
Okay, let's do it.
So before the break, I was talking about proof of citizenship for registering to vote with birth certificates and passports. But one interesting thing I thought that I hadn't considered is this idea of registering in advance. So for example, in New York requires voters to register at least 25 days before an election.
Okay.
So it's so funny because we talk about earlier, we were talking about just the inconvenience of getting a document, right? Mm-hmm. Identification document, and how much of a burden and a pain that can be if you have to go down and actually get it. Well, imagine you're just sitting there and you're like, you just feel compelled. You know what? Today I'm going to vote. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get up and I'm going to vote. Whatever inspires that, you would think that in the United States, because we value democracy, that would be something that you would be able to do. Mm-hmm. But in the state of New York, you need at least 25 days before voting, before an election, you need to register. Mm-hmm. So anytime before that 25 days, you're not allowed to vote in that election.
That's crazy.
Yeah. In 2016, the presidential election, over 90,000 New Yorkers were unable to vote because their application did not meet the 25-day cutoff, and the state had the eighth worst turnout rate in the country.
Wow. So you can see how these laws are dramatically affecting voter turnout.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a country that is already dealing with a lot of voter apathy, see our episode on voting generally, for more information. But that's a real issue. And you're talking about New York being one of the most populated states and had the eighth worst turnout.
Right.
That is incredibly worrisome.
Yeah. But that's just something that you could be viewed as like, oh, I just need to do it 25 days before. Mm-hmm. But I just think that example of like inspiration.
Yeah.
You may feel resentful for the whole voting and democracy and my vote doesn't count. But for one instant, the day you're allowed to vote, you feel inspired to do so.
Mm-hmm.
In some states, you're just not allowed to.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Well, and then most of these are passed under the guise that it's about protecting the integrity of our election. But as multiple public and private and audits have found and statistics show, that this is not a voter impersonation, right, is not a problem in this country as much as we're being told that it is.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I found was a retired conservative Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who upheld a challenge to restriction in Ohio that made it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court had upheld it. The conservative Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, who had been on that case, stated he regretted his decision to uphold, Indiana's voter ID laws by stating that these laws are now widely regarded as a means of voter suppression rather than fraud prevention.
Mm.
And that's a Supreme Court justice who at the time ruled in favor of these ID laws. And then later on, once you see the effects of these things,
right,
realize that it's not a solution. It's a solution to a problem, but it's a solution to a different problem than what is stated.
I think what you're saying there that's important is he saw the impact of that ruling, right?
Yeah.
He saw the data of that ruling. You can see you can see the impact, right?
Yeah.
Voter fraud, there is no impact. But here, making a decision to prevent voter impact, there's the data that reflects it.
Yeah.
How important is that, you know? Voter purges. This is one that you and I came across. We're like, wait, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Voter purges. So this is literally the system, the elections administration in states purging, I guess, is the adjective we're using here, or verb we're using here.
Yeah.
But basically, purging voter rolls of people who have changed their addresses or have died, or some states have restrictions on felons, and we'll get to that too. Yeah.
The state governments will go through lists of registered voters and remove people off of that who are no longer eligible to vote for various reasons or have died.
Right.
Yeah.
The most common excuses for purging voter rolls are to filter out voters who have changed their address, died, or failed to vote in recent elections.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, Arkansas purged thousands of voters for so-called felony convictions, even though some of the voters had never been convicted of a felony at all.
Mm-hmm. And think about that. If you went to, you probably wouldn't even be notified of that until you went to the polls to vote and you realized that you're not on the list to be able to vote.
Yeah. In 2013, Virginia purged 39,000 voters based on data that was later found to have an error rate up to 17%.
Wow.
So
that's high.
Just, this is an interesting one as far as voter suppression, because I think there could be an argument made for and against this purge.
Yes.
Well,
I think that when done right, the purge is a necessary thing that the state governments are doing. But as we've seen, there's errors.
Mm-hmm.
There's insufficient oversight, according to Brennan Center Justice, who is an absolute opponent of this voter purging system, because a lot of states don't have transparency in doing it, and so there's no way to review their criteria for removing people off, and there's no oversight over it. So there could be, as you're saying, an error rate up to 17%, and there's no oversight on that. So how is it ever going to get better?
Right.
And I think that's the issue with voter purging, is that there isn't any sort of mechanism in place or federal standard saying that there needs to be certain criteria being met by the states when doing these purging, because this is a federal election, but it's open to however the state wants to do it when enacting these voter purges.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's room there for the federal government to step in and set a standard, especially when it comes to transparency.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
The next one I have is felony disenfranchisement. This one was interesting to me because, again, at the state level, there are so many different regulations. Mm-hmm. So a felony conviction can come with drastic consequences, including the loss of your right to vote. So some ban voting only during incarceration. Some ban voting for life. Some ban people while on probation or parole. Mm-hmm. Others ban people from voting only while incarcerated. It said that. And some states like Maine and Vermont don't disenfranchise people with felony convictions at all. So I think what's interesting about this felony disenfranchisement is the dramatic variations between laws. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that kind of throughout this whole episode, how different states have different rules and laws and restrictions. But with this specific instance, you can either vote sometimes or at a certain point or not at all, or your vote is never removed. Mm-hmm. I think that is also something I think you could argue that needs to have a federal consideration.
Sure.
You know, a federal look at this. Mm-hmm. To maybe set a standard in some way, because these are, whether or not you agree, mm-hmm, if they should or should not vote, or when they should not vote, these are American citizens that we're talking about here.
Hey, that's a
it is.
It's a difficult.
There's so many arguments that could be made for or against this.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about the mass incarceration of African Americans who, as a proportion of the population, make up a lot higher percentage of people who are in prison, mm-hmm, and this episode isn't talking about police issues specifically, but there is a problem with the target with disproportionate incarceration of minorities in this country that. When you're talking about but if you were to tie that to the voting issue, yeah, that's a tough topic.
You bring up that point, and I want to say here that in the reading it says right here, it comes as no surprise that many of these laws are rooted in Jim Crow era when, mm-hmm, legislators tried to block Black American votes. To this day, the states with the most extreme disenfranchisement laws also have long records of suppressing the rights of Black people. In Iowa, a system of permanent disenfranchisement paired with the most disproportionate incarceration rate of Black people in the nation has resulted in disenfranchisement of an estimated 1 in 4 voting age Black men.
Wow. That's insane.
Again, that's just something that needs to be considered. Mm-hmm. As a form of suppression.
Yeah. Just one other note that I found here, and this is kind of ties back to more of the voter ID, but it's not specifically that way, but it related to that. It's just kind of just building on this idea that we're giving evidence to, mm-hmm, is that in 2017, Georgia enacted an exact match law mandating that voters' names on registration cards must perfectly match their names on approved forms of identification, approved forms of identification being state-issued documents.
Right.
So if a clerk makes an error, which I work in, I conduct background checks for my line of work all the time, you'd be amazed how much DMV misspells people's names. All of the time. And then if it's misspelled on DMV, it's a government error, I still can't run that background check.
Yeah.
So if you think about voting and you walk up and it's a clerical error that you didn't have time to then go back and fix, you can't, all of a sudden now you can't vote.
Yeah.
In the lead up to the 2018 election, approximately 80% of Georgia voters who were registered, who were blocked by this law, mm-hmm, were people of color.
Mm, the exact match law. Mm-hmm. Anecdotal evidence here of something that I know, someone who is a truck driver needs to have matching. Your ID trying to get a hazmat endorsement. Mm-hmm. As simple as, let's use your name as an example, Jake, your ID or your birth certificate or whatever it is, the document you need to get that endorsement, mm-hmm, it said Jade, J-A-D-E, mm-hmm, it said J-A-K-E. Well, now he had to go and correct all that documentation in order to get this hazmat endorsement.
Yeah.
Now apply that to voting.
Yeah.
It's a mess. Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I think we all have anecdotes.
For sure.
Where we can apply to this general rule that we're building. But so I think lastly, we're going to talk about the issue of gerrymandering, which doesn't directly affect votes or to limit people from voting, but it is a way in which it changes the very representation of this country. And as you know, as we've talked about at length, you know, we have a bicameral federal legislature. We have a Senate and we have a House of Representatives. The House of Representatives being a body that is with a cap of 435 representatives that come from congressional districts that are drawn on the map based on proportion of population. Who decides where those boundaries are drawn? Those congressional districts are drawn after the census is taken every 10 years. The issue of gerrymandering, it's hard to map, and it's even harder to prove, but there has been instances where gerrymandering has been proven. The issue is so if you have a population of 50, say, just for example, you have a small group of 50 people. Mm-hmm. Two-thirds are people who vote for the red party. Mm-hmm. One-third are people who vote for the blue party. They're all mapped around. But so then you say you have to draw that into five congressional districts. Mm-hmm. Now, if you were to have if you wanted to have a pure representation of that population distribution, you would have it so that there was one-third representation for the people who voted for the blue party. Mm-hmm. And two-thirds of representation of people who voted for the red party.
Right.
But when you're talking about the drawing of congressional districts, if you just move those lines around to where those people are distributed and voting from, eventually you can skew it in a way to where that when you have elections in each one of those districts, there is an over proportion of people who vote for the red party in each one of those districts. So then you end up having a skewed distribution or representation based on what the actual population is.
Right.
Did I make sense with
that?
Yes,
you did.
Okay. All right.
It directly affects the representation of that area. Mm-hmm. And again, suppresses the voice of certain voters in that area.
Yeah.
That was well said. Okay, I just wanted to kind of cap this off with, you know, we talked about the history. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so much, there's deep roots in that history and just beautiful examples of change, but we still have a long way to go. And that leads me to who is affected by voter suppression today.
Mm-hmm.
I think overall, all of us.
Yeah.
All of us are. Because our democracy is debased when the right to vote or voting is not accessible for everyone who lives here.
Mm-hmm.
But more specifically, I have some statistics here. 70% of Georgia voters purged in 2018 were black.
70%?
70. Across the country, 1 in 13 black Americans cannot vote due to disenfranchisement laws. Today, currently. One-third of voters who have a disability report difficulty voting. And that's another thing that we didn't talk about, but location, mm-hmm. or limited location, and how that affects, as the statistic shows, people with disabilities.
Yeah.
And their access to going to the polls. Only 40% of polling places fully accommodate with people with disabilities. So there's that statistic. Across the country, counties with large minority populations have fewer polling sites and poll workers per voter. And that's another issue, is poll workers.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have funding there to pay people to run the polls, that's going to limit the places to vote. 6 in 10 college students come from out of state in New Hampshire, the state trying to block residents with out of state driver's licenses
from voting.
I just don't get it. I mean, obviously it's with the intention of limiting choice and voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this intentional process and processes to limit these, one of the most foundational things we can do, mm-hmm. one of the most important things we can do is and you know, you always say on Say What You Mean, watch the watchers, right?
Yeah.
And we do that by voting.
Yep.
And if you limit that, then we are limited in having a voice, but also, you know, designing and controlling the government.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the watching the watchers is, I mean, that is how we make sure that our representative form of government, which is intended to make sure that we have our civil liberties and our constitutional promises are being upheld. But it's the way that we make sure that the government is keeping within our interests, which I think you nailed it perfectly, because like the pushback to these voter, like to any critiques of these voter ID laws is like, well, how difficult is it to just go get a to just go get an ID. You should just have an ID. I don't see there's an issue with that. And I think empirically you look at it and you're like, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense. Just go get an ID. But there is so many, there are so many things that can keep that from happening. And I think we've discussed a few of the large ones here, but every individual situation is different. And it when you talk about the aggregate and you talk about over the broad scope of our elections and the broad scope of our population, there's a lot of people who are being silenced. And the vast majority of those voices being silenced are racial minorities and people of color.
And that silencing doesn't just affect who's in the White House. It affects school districts, school funding, just so many things throughout our society that the voting controls. And when you're suppressing those votes, that representation is not reflected in the society. Some things I'm thinking about, you know, that you can do as a listener to try to help. But I think most importantly is like, know your rights, know them, and know the laws, obviously, but challenge them, Don't be afraid to challenge those, you know, ID laws or whatever it may be, whether it's with your vote or writing to your representative. But some other things you could do, I mean, to make sure you're voting is vote early. You know, as we see with the case of New York, you've been registering early. It's unfortunate that they have that. But in those places, again, just be proactive when you're voting. Participate. Yeah, that's all I have for some advice.
Yeah, I think that's a good message to end on. Voting's important. Without it, we lose our democracy. So, I mean, really vote like, I mean, I think Beyonce said it, vote like your life depends on it.
Well, and I think, you know, we always say on the show we choose to end it this way, and it couldn't be more just relevant, but remember to vote and stay informed.
Yeah, and that's a great way to end it. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back next month. Jeff, thank you for sitting in again. Your wisdom is always appreciated. So would like to have you back on whenever you have time.
I'll be back.
You'll be back. Thank goodness. All right. Thank you guys all for listening. This is To the Republic. I'm Jake.
And I'm Jeff.
We'll see you next month.
Bye.
KXRW is brought to you by the generous support from our friends at New Vansterdam. They are the premier cannabis market in the Vancouver area. You can visit at newvansterdam.com for more information regarding their specials and discount days like CBD Sunday and Munchie Monday. New Vansterdam is located in the Heights Shopping Center on the corner of Mill Plain and Andreessen Road. Open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. 365 days a year. More information available at newvansterdam.com.
Community radio like this is brought to you by the generous support by our founding sponsors at ADCO Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at ADCO1.com. That's ADCO1.com.